Welcome back to the Jason Grant Show. Many times amidst instances of gun violence, folks will claim that the issue is more about mental health and less about the guns. Well, a professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine says, nope, it's not about mental health. It's about the actual weapon. It's about the guns. Dr. Kimberly Yonkers has a very provocative piece in the Washington Post, and she joins me now. Dr. Yonkers, I appreciate it.
Hi, thank you.
With the authority of, your background as a mental health expert, you write, this obsession with mental health as the root cause of gun violence is not only silly, it's dangerous. So why is it dangerous?
Well, the whole point of this piece was to have people take a look at, take the global view of this. And in this country, after gruesome or terrible events of gun violence, I just noticed as a mental health professional that people are very quick to blame the mental health system or blame mental illness on the violence that's been perpetrated. And so one of the things that, as an epidemiologist and somebody who's looked at psychiatric services and also has been interested in psychiatric services globally, one of the things that strikes me is we don't see a lot of differences across the globe in particularly severe and persistent mental illness in terms of the prevalence, right?
Okay.
We, among high-resource countries, we really don't see a lot of differences in the attention and care that's provided to individuals with psychiatric conditions, especially severe and persistent mental illness. So from my perspective, to blame psychiatric illness or the services that people receive in the treatment of their psychiatric illness for the gun violence that we see in our country compared to other high-resource countries just doesn't make sense. If it really was a problem with mental illness or if it really was a problem with mental health services, then we would see rates of gun violence, especially homicide, we would see rates as high as we have in our country as we have in other countries. And we have some data on that, and one of the particularly well-known studies in psychiatry is the World Mental Health Survey. And what the World Mental Health Survey did is they looked at the prevalence of psychiatric conditions across the globe, including multiple high-resource countries, and they also looked at psychiatric services that were provided. Piece suggests that there aren't a lot of differences in the rates of mental illness, especially severe and persistent mental illness like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, in high-resource countries, and we don't see a lot of differences, at least in the resources that are devoted to mental health care. So the provocative piece of that is before we rush to blame mental illness or the services provided to individuals with mental illness, we should take a look at our colleagues in other high-resource countries, and that would tell us that there's something else going on here.
Is it possible?
And the elephant in the room is that we have a greater availability to guns than other countries do, and so that may actually be the difference rather than the prevalence of mental illness or the services that individuals with mental illness receive.
Is it possible, though, when we look at the amount of access to potential treatment for mental illness, you point out in your piece that we have 19 mental health professionals and almost 3.5 psychiatric beds per 10,000 people, which are similar in rates to that of at least Western Europe and what you refer to as the high-resource nations. But at the same time, mental health in this country, mental illness, is one of the highest as a percentage of the population, according to the World Health Organization, much higher than some of the countries. A big chunk of people in this country suffer from addiction, though not as high in other countries.
According to the World Mental Health Survey, there are some differences in the prevalence of mental illnesses across the various countries. Now, part of that may be attributable to cultural differences. And the willingness, for example, of an individual, say, in Japan or, you know, even a European country to actually admit that they have problems, for example, with anxiety or depression. And we know that there are some cultural differences in terms of people answering questions about, on surveys, questions about anxiety, depression, other symptoms. And there is a huge cultural overlay. You know, for example, one of the areas that I've worked in quite a bit is gender differences and the possible cultural effects in responses to surveys that lead to diagnoses, and whether there are differences in women and men and how they respond to certain questions, and whether that is responsible for the difference in prevalence rates that we see for major depressive disorder. So just as an example, major depressive disorder occurs at a higher rate in females than males, and you go across the globe and it's the same, it's roughly the same, you know, it's 1.5 to 2 times as high in women as it is in men. So there are some sex and there are some cultural differences in how people respond to the surveys. But what's important to keep in mind in this whole bigger picture is when we look at the survey responders who have severe and persistent mental illness, which is more difficult to have an, in some ways it's more difficult to make an error in diagnosing an individual who has a very severe psychiatric condition than people who have milder conditions, because you're less dependent on sort of reporting bias. So when you look at the severe and persistent mental illness, there really isn't much difference across high resource countries. You
but
know,
that
you
also,
see that.
That also takes out, I think, an important part of this equation is the fact that in the United States, and again, I'm quoting the World Health Organization, they claim that about 41% of people who are suffering from mental health illness in this country, they don't actually seek treatment.
There is a problem in terms of people seeking treatment in our country. There's a problem people seeking treatment across the globe, though.
Sure, but so, I only make that point in the sense of when we compare the amount of actual services and the amount of beds and the amount of doctors, that's only relevant so much as if people actually use them.
Yes. One of the interesting things that you see in our country is actually you see a high rate of utilization in our country, and one of the highest of the high-income countries. So from that, the World Mental Health Survey, you see, you know, that the rate of utilization was actually one of the highest. The 12-month service rate was almost 18%. When you look at the distribution of who's using mental health services, though, it's very interesting because you see in the United States, there are a lot of people who didn't have a diagnosis that was generated in the survey who are accessing mental health services. You don't see much difference in the rate of utilization among those with severe and persistent mental illness, the really severe conditions. It's sort of in the middle that you start to see the differences. But there certainly are maldistributions. And, you know, as I mentioned in the piece that I wrote, you know, one of the vagaries of our healthcare system is we don't have the same access in many instances as individuals in other countries who have universal health care. We don't have universal health care. And we see that there are people who have mental health needs that do not receive the care that they need because they don't have the appropriate insurance.
But Dr. Yonkers, doesn't that go to the point that this is a little bit about mental health, and it's actually a big part? And the reason I bring that up is in 2010, there were about 30,000 gun deaths in this country, deaths that were attributed to gun violence. How many of those were suicide?
Suicides are definitely one of the highest.
It is the highest.
You know, it's Trump homicides in terms of...
Overwhelmingly.
Pardon me?
Overwhelmingly. I mean, of that number of 30,000,
yes,
it's 19,000, give or take a couple hundred, were suicides due to guns. And so if over half of the gun deaths in this country are coming from suicides, well over half, how often do people with mental health issues commit suicide in your experience as a psychiatrist? Presumably you say it's rather high.
Now, the interesting thing about guns and suicide is guns are a particularly potent way to commit suicide. Guns tend to lead to they're very effective methods for suicide, right? So we see high rates of gun suicide because guns are so effective at causing death. If we didn't have the guns, we would see a lower rate of gun suicide.
If we didn't see the mental health, if we didn't see the folks who were suffering from mental health to the point of being suicidal, we wouldn't see the suicides, period, and still have those guns, right?
Well, you know, I mean, people who are in the mental health system, even people who are being treated, still commit suicide.
Exactly. But my point is, let's say, because it sounds like if you take the gun out of the equation, your claim is that there would be less suicide. Certainly there would be
that
less
suicide.
Yeah, and I believe that that's
that is correct.
And probably true.
And the reason that is because guns are so effective
sure.
at helping people commit suicide. I mean, I like to shy away from some terms like being successful or helpful because,
sure.
you know, somebody committing suicide is not a favorable outcome. But, you know, having somebody take a gun and shoot themselves, they're more likely to have a completed attempt than having somebody take an overdose or multiple
sure.
other methods of suicide.
So, yeah, I think that's a fair point. My point, though, is saying in that scenario, you took away guns, which is a constitutionally protected item to have in this country. Whether or not that people like that idea, I'm certainly up for that debate, but you and I will concede that there is a right to bear arms in this country in some way, depending on how you view things, certainly depending on how I view things. And so in your scenario, you are leading to less likely suicide if you take away the gun. To my point, you can still have the gun, but if you actually treat the mental illness, you would then preserve the Second Amendment rights while also putting a huge dent in the actual number of gun deaths in this country.
See, but that's where I think there's a problem in your argument because
okay.
what I'm saying is that there are also people who are undergoing treatment that successfully complete a suicide. So, you know,
doesn't that go to the treatment not being complete?
As a clinician, it's virtually impossible to be 100% accurate.
Sure.
Knowing who is going to commit suicide or homicide. And, you know, there are even data on following up people who have presented to emergency departments. So we can't know that. And just because somebody is undergoing treatment doesn't mean that they are going to not have a successful suicide attempt.
Sure, but I'm saying it's still the mental
with gun
illness.
Violence is, with gun violence, is it's such an effective way that more times than not, there is no second chance.
Yeah, but it's a more effective way to commit suicide if you are mentally ill. And I guess that's my point. So the claim that this is not a mental illness problem, I think, is somewhat disingenuous. Because if we're talking about people who are mentally ill, who are killing themselves, and those are the people who are overwhelmingly using weapons to kill themselves, it's not so simple as to say, well, it's a gun issue, it's not a mental illness issue. If anything, it's both.
Well, there may be, it isn't simply one or the other. However, what I would maintain is without such a lethal means of suicide, the chances that there would be a completed suicide are lower.
Why don't you mention suicide in your piece in the Washington Post?
You know what? Because I wanted to write a second piece specifically talking about suicide, because I think you're right. There is far less attention to suicide than, you know, some of the more spectacular episodes of gun violence that we see. I think we need to look at broader solutions. And I think, you know, it's a problem to just focus on mental illness, and it's a problem to just focus on the mental health system.
Yeah, we shouldn't focus singularly on anything, and I totally agree with that. My issue was with this particular piece in the Washington Post, you seem to downplay the importance of the role that mental illness plays. And in the piece, you even go so far as, you know, you say eliminating poverty, domestic violence, and childhood exposure to bloodshed would likely make a dent in our problem with gun violence. Then you go on to say it may have even made a difference in the life of Ishmael Brinsley, of course, the gentleman who killed the two NYPD officers just a few weeks ago. But he suffered from mental illness. According to the New York Times, he had a history of suffering of mental illness issues.
Well, you know, it's not my job to, I never met the man, and I'm not going to make secondary diagnoses. This clearly, though, was a very troubled young man. And what happened in his particular instance was beyond somebody who had, for example, a refractory major depressive disorder and killed himself because of that. I mean, there is, you know, his whole life, it appears, was replete with trouble on various levels. And, you know, certainly people can be despondent at the very end and feel hopeless and feel that their life has amounted to nothing and turn a gun on themselves. And I can't say post hoc whether he had major depressive disorder or not. You know, certainly the reports suggest that he was in a great deal of distress. And they also suggest that this is, unfortunately, an individual that was subjected to violence and, you know, had contended with, you know, he was in jail, he contended with violence there and in his neighborhood. So it wasn't unusual for him to turn to violence after having experienced so much violence in his life. And but I do want to thank you for a chance to talk about this. I think your perspective is very, very interesting. And, you know, I think we do need to continue to have dialogues like this. And I think people should continue to reflect on this. So I want to wish you and your program.
Dr. Yonkers, can I ask you one final question?
Yes.
What is a policy prescription that you recommend to tackle your view of the gun violence problem?
Well, thank you very much for that question, but, you know, I'm a doctor. I'm not a politician.
Sure, but you say we have to do something more meaningful. You know, when people say that, presumably they have some semblance of an idea, and I don't mean to do the X's and O's of, like, a specific policy prescription.
I think taking a very close look at this, I mean, when you look at, you know, gun homicide, at least half of the guns that are used in homicides are obtained illegally. I think that there's something to be said for that. I think we've shied away from promoting things like smart weapons, you know, which can be, you know, the sort of smart technology where it's one user and the gun fits them. You have to have, you know, it has to be signaled and tied to a certain
handprint or, sort of technology that identifies them with the user.
I think that there are sort of technological advances that can be made. So,
you're not calling for a ban on weapons?
I'm not calling for a ban on weapons, but I think what we really need to do is we really need to look at how to have these available safely.
Yeah, and I think most people in this country, regardless of what side of the First, the Second Amendment they're on, would agree with that. Whereas we need to keep guns out of the hands of the people who shouldn't have them.
But I also have to say that as a psychiatrist and somebody who takes care of individuals who suffer from a mental illness, that I do find it very troubling that people always blame the mentally ill and they always blame the mental health system. And I don't think that that's a fair rap. And I think we have to be broader as when we think about this and when we think about our policies.
Fair enough. I've been talking with Dr. Kimberly Yonkers. She's a professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine. We are posting her Washington Post editorial on our Facebook page if you want to check it out. Again, facebook.com/Jason Rantz Show. Dr. Yonkers, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show. We're back in 4 minutes.
Incinerator.
Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show. It's time for a new segment called The Incinerator. And we're taking your calls. 1-888-973-KIRO. 888-973-KIRO. Here's how The Incinerator works. It's a lot of times throughout the week, we have maybe a bad meeting at work. We get a bill that we weren't expecting. We get into a fight with a loved one, and it sort of puts us in a really bad mood. And it's kind of that bad mood you can't shake. It sticks with you the entire time. And you're like, oh my God, I don't want to go into the weekend feeling this negativity. So I brought together the incinerator. And what do we do with the incinerator? Let's open this thing up. There we go.
Ooh.
Oh, that incinerator.
There's some fire.
We take all the nastiness, all the negativity, and we throw it into the incinerator, and then it goes away. And then we're able to enjoy our weekend without all that negativity. Now, I'm opening up the phone calls to you so you can give us your your bad mojo, the negativity, and we will symbolically throw it into the fiery pits of hell. Let's start with you, Nick, because let's get this out of the way, because we have stressful jobs at times. We get a little nutty, and, you know, in our personal lives, every once in a while, things happen. What do you want to throw into the incinerator?
I know exactly what I want to throw in there. I washed my girlfriend's car this week, and by I washed, I mean I got it washed. And then hours later, probably because I parked it under a tree afterwards, a bird poops on it.
Aww.
I walk out to go pick her up from work, and I'm like, come on!
Yeah.
Already?
That's annoying.
Already with the bird poop? Just wash the thing.
Oh, my God. That's
what
annoying.
I want to throw in the incinerator.
Okay, let's do this. Throwing it in. It's
good.
Gone. Doesn't it
that
really
feels
feel
really
good? You're able to just be like, yeah, I'm done with that.
Yeah.
If you want to call in with what your version is that you want to throw into the incinerator, the lines are open, 1-888-973-KIRO. That's 888-973-5476. Tatiana in Kent, you're on the Jason Rance Show. What has been bothering you this week?
Well, it happened today. I got a text message from my landlord. What a professional way to do it. Saying that he's going to raise my rent to $1,480, and I have to pay all the utilities, which in my lease was never included by me. He had to pay it.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it with less than a 24-hour notice, saying that I'm now responsible for the water, trash, and sewer as of January 1st of 2015.
So your rent has been increased to a little over $1,400. What was it?
It was 13.
Okay, so yeah, that's kind of, when does it go into effect?
January 1st, 2015. And look at the date. Today's the 19th.
I think they have to give you 30, depending on where you're in Kent, so I think they have to give you at least 30 days notice.
60 days.
60 days notice.
Yeah.
You should fight that,
I'm
Tatiana.
Kind of panicking.
No, I hear you. Well, the first thing you need to do is fight that. But before that, we got to clear your mind just a little bit. Just a little, even though I know it's really, really tough. But you want to go into this fight a little level-headed. So here, let me open this thing. Okay, I literally just pushed all your bad mojo in there, Tatiana. It's in the incinerator.
I have a smile on my face. Thank you.
Perfect. See, it works, Tatiana. It works. Thanks for calling the Jason Rance Show. It absolutely works. If you want to throw in the bad mojo into the incinerator, call 1-888-973-KIRO. Tyler and Burien, you're on the Jason Rance Show. What has been getting you down this week?
Jason, thanks for having me on. First thing that's bringing me down is the extra horrendous traffic on my first week back to school in 3 years.
Oh, what's the traffic been like? Because I know that it can get very bad. Where are you starting from, presumably in Burien? Where are you going?
Burien to Bellevue.
And how long does it take you in traffic?
So normally it takes me about 20 minutes. This week it's been taking me about a half an hour to 45 minutes.
Ugh. It's so weird sometimes. We only talk about a little extra time than we're used to, maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes. In the grand scheme of things, that's not a lot. Until you realize you're stuck in the car and you're not moving. And you're going incredibly slow. And then all of a sudden, that 5 to 10 to 15 minutes sounds way worse than it actually is. So let me open the door of the incinerator and let's push your bad mojo into it. And hopefully next week, it'll be a little bit better. Here we go. Oh, did you hear that little scream, Tyler? That scream was all of the bad negativity in your life magically dispersing. Tyler, I appreciate your call.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Go Hawks.
Go Hawks. 1-888-973-KIRO is the number. Let us know about what's just been bugging you, and let's symbolically get rid of that nonsense so you can enjoy the weekend. Ronald in Bremerton, what has been bothering you?
Oh, kind of like the last caller, my commute. I have been dealing with the ferry system and our local traffic setup. I work for the government, and I've been commuting from Bremerton to Marysville 5 days a week.
Oh, my gosh. How long does that normally take you? What would that normally take you without the crazy traffic?
An hour and 40 minutes is the normal amount of time.
Did you get moved to Marysville and you're stuck in Bremerton? Or, like, did you have a job that was a little bit closer before?
it's all a part of the whole plan that I had. But long story short, I'm transferring, and tomorrow is my last day of this commute. So,
oh, so then
you could help.
Oh, absolutely. Hold on, let me get the. It's God. It's so hot in here. Hold on 1 second. Oh, that scream! That was very similar to the scream from the last commute, guys. So we know that it's consistently killing off all these bad mojo from the commute. Ronald, I appreciate you calling.
I feel better. Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. 1-888-973-KIRO. Joanne and Enumclaw, what's going on? What has been getting you down that you want to throw into that incinerator?
Well, actually, it's a bunch of things. At Christmas, my niece came out and only spent an hour with the family because her other family that has somewhat adopted her was more important. Then my grandfather died, and again, she only came out for a half an hour, and she wants nothing to do with this part of her family, and it just has been really weighing heavy on our hearts.
Joanne, how old is she?
She is 24.
Okay, so here's the good thing. Because I'm 32, and I sometimes experience the wanting just to get a separate, just have that separation from family in general and be a little independent. I feel like maybe that's what's at play here. And it absolutely will pass, but it's going to suck for a bit. But the good the good news is, Joanne, we can literally, at least symbolically, you and I, let's just push that bad mojo into the incinerator, okay?
Yes.
Okay, hold on. It's so hot in here, I can barely open this thing. There we go. Oh, and just like that, Joanne, it is all gone. It feels just a little bit better, doesn't it? Just a little bit better. Perfect, Joanne. I appreciate you calling. You're listening to the Jason Rant Show. This is our brand new segment. We're going to do this every single Friday because there are things during the week that just gets us down that we can't quite get over, and we don't want it to ruin our weekends, especially when we've got the Seahawks playing tomorrow. Gene and Ballard, what has been going on that you just need to symbolically burn?
It's the insurance company, my health insurance.
Okay, what's going on with the insurance?
Okay, I have the state Washington health insurance, which I'm really happy I have, but I never got the letter saying that they were going to switch me to a different carrier because I am apartment A, and the people below me are apartment B, and they had me down for B. And I don't know what the neighbors did with my mail or anything, but I went to get my prescriptions, and they said, oh, I'm sorry, you'll have to wait till Monday. This is happening with a lot of people up here. The state's doing that. And I said, okay.
So, you know what? I'm going to do two things that I'm going to throw into the incinerator for you, okay? First, the bad mojo from the mistake that was made by the healthcare program. But also, I'm going to, because if we're going to be honest, Gene, it's going to take a little bit of a time for them to actually fix this. So you're going to have some bad mojo from next week, too. I'm connecting it together right now mentally. And let's open this thing, and I'm going to throw it in there with me, okay? You ready?
Yes.
Oh, did you hear that scream? That scream was extra impactful because...
Oh, it sounds like my basement. Okay, thank you.
Oh, God, where do you live, Gene? I appreciate you calling. Let's take one more call. Lisa in Seattle. We've got about 30 seconds.
Hi. Mail theft and lack of help from the police department. So I've had my mail stolen 3 times in the last 2 months.
What kind of mail are they stealing? Have you figured that out?
Everything. Oh, well, they leave my bills and flyers.
When they leave the bills, you know, that is so inconsiderate. If you're going to be a jerk and steal stuff, steal the bills too. Lisa, let's open this thing together. Okay, it's a little hot. Watch your hands. Hopefully that helps just a little bit, Lisa. Good luck on this, okay? The Seattle PD, they know what they're doing. Give them some time, okay?
Will do. Thanks.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show. We are back in 4 minutes. The Jason Rant Show. That was fun. I don't take calls all that often. We're going to start doing that every single Friday night. We're going to open the call lines for the incinerator. If you want to send us an email, go ahead. What's stopping you? Go to mynorthwest.com. Click on the Linwood Honda inbox. Search for the name Jason Rants. Today, we saw President Obama make the case for free community college enrollment for the nation's about 9 million people who would be eligible, specifically students. Speaking in front of a crowd in Knoxville, Tennessee today, the president said this.
Community colleges should be free for those willing to work for it. Because in America, quality education cannot be a privilege that is reserved for a few. I think it's a right for everybody who's willing to work for it. Now, the good news is you already do something like this in Tennessee. You call it Tennessee Promise. So you call it Tennessee Promise, and we thought, why not just build on what works? So we're going to call it America's College Promise.
The White House says the average student can save $3,800 a year as long as he or she makes good grades and good progress towards graduation. Now, the president was very light on details, but was heavy on emphasizing that all parties must be accountable if this program's going to work.
And the concept is simple. America's College Promise will make 2 years of community college free to responsible students who are willing to work for it. Students would have to do their part by keeping their grades up. Colleges would have to do their part by offering high-quality academics and helping students actually graduate. States would have to do their part, too. This isn't a blank check. It's not a free lunch. But for those willing to do the work, and for states and local communities that want to be a part of this, it can be a game changer.
It's really interesting because presumably you make the judgment as to whether or not someone's going to pay after they go through a semester or two, right? So it's not free if the students actually go through and don't get the good grades. Well, what if they tried really hard and they end up failing to get that 2.5? What if they got a 2.4? They tried really, really, really hard. They only, in fact, went to the school, this JC, because they thought that they would get it paid for. So the school then admits the student. He or she ends up finishing the year or the semester, depending on, you know, what they're actually looking at as far as the aggregate of the grade. And they finish with just slightly below the grade point average that they have required, the 2.5. So the school then goes after the money from the kid who just went to the school who thought it was going to be free. In fact, they only went because it was free because they know they can't afford the $3,800 or so. What? I legitimately, that doesn't seem to be a smart move. I mean, that legitimately seems to be a really big loophole in this. And I don't know how they're doing it in Tennessee. I'm very curious as to see how they're doing it in Tennessee, as well as how many JCs there actually are in Tennessee and the cost to go to a junior college or a community college in that particular state. Because that seems to be a really, really, really big loophole. Now, this is not going to pass. This 100%, there is no shot in hell that this thing gets passed, even if it might be a good idea. And it's not going to get passed for a number of reasons, the most of which being there's no actual funding for this on a federal level, and that pesky little thing called supply. There's not a supply for those 9 million in this country, okay? And a good example is when you go to any major city, you've got a number of junior colleges, but you don't have that many, and they tend to be really full, okay? They tend to be really full, and there's a lot in this country that have tons and tons and tons of people being stacked in like sardines to some of these colleges. This is simply a talking point, and it is strategic. This whole idea is strategic because he's only doing it to demonize the Republicans. When this doesn't pass, then he'll blame it on the Republicans, though he's been making this pitch as far back as the first time he ran for president.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I voted for Obama back in 2008, he was talking about this very thing, except they were framing it as like, you go join the Peace Corps or whatever, and your college will be
community
paid for.
Community service, like, in some form.
Yeah, community service, and your college is paid for. I was like, that sounds like a great idea. I'm a teen. I should vote for that.
Exactly. And the thing is, you were a teen at the time. That's who he was going after. He was trying to get people like you, the ones who are like, look, I want to go to college.
And he won the young vote by a lot.
Well, exactly. And that's my point. Because what's going to happen here? By the way, when he was first elected into office, that time when he had the total control of the Senate and the House, did they make any movement on this whatsoever? Where did that idea go? It didn't go anywhere because it didn't have the support of the Democrats. But all of a sudden, now you've got Republicans in control of Congress. He's going to float this idea. He's going to talk about it in the State of the Union. It's going to go nowhere the same way it didn't go anywhere the first time around. And then all of a sudden, what happens? You blame the Republicans. You say this was all the fault of the Republicans. Hey, Hillary. You want to get some of those young votes that I had? Well, why don't you practice by saying this? It's all the fault of the Republicans. Republicans are to blame. And the problem is going in, any Democrat who goes into the next election, it's likely going to be Hillary, but whomever it is, they have to deal with something that they didn't think they'd have to deal with, which is the fact that a lot of younger voters are not going to go out and actually vote. Why? Because Barack Obama was a very unique politician who got people really, really, really excited. And the people who got really, really, really excited, two groups of people, minorities and young people, both of which don't tend to vote all that often, not in the record numbers that you saw with President Obama. So he's throwing a little bit of a bone to whoever it happens to be who's running next, because they don't want to see a Republican in office. It makes him seem like a really good guy. In fact, he's going to go out on top in his own mind saying, man, I left. If only I could get the Republicans to stop being so evil, I could have gotten not only free health care for the entire country, but I could have also gotten free college. Man, those Scrooge Republicans not willing to spend anything. When the truth, if the Republicans are truly smart, they should try and pass this thing. They should go on a strategic limb, try and pass this thing and say, you know what? Yeah, we support it. Do it. See how far it goes. Because they don't have, they do not have a plan to implement this. The reason they don't have a plan, the reason why they're light on details is they say, oh, well, they're going to get more details during the State of the Union. No, they're not. You're going to get a talking point. You're going to get bumper stickers during the State of the Union, because that's generally all you get, regardless of whether it's a Republican or Democrat. You only get talking points. And that's a shame, because a lot of people out there are being fooled into thinking that this is an actual reality, when in fact it's not. When we come back, the top 10 films of 2014, Tom Tangney stops by.